getting a lot more press.
All right, so let's roll and live streaming on all of my networks. You know, it's amazing what I'm doing now that I don't have to worry about censorship since I've decided not to broadcast on YouTube, even though I have a YouTube station. I just don't want to. I'm tired of getting dinged all the time over there. So I've launched this program with Rumble being the flagship.
Right.
And Rumble. And I'm also on an increasing number of live streams simultaneously, probably at this point up to 10, including my own. Here I am, basically running this whole deal right out of my attic. I mean, I've got my Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn pages live. And I also am on DLive and Twitch and about three or four others. And then it gets downloaded into some of the big podcast sites. I'm getting a lot of traffic on Apple, and I'm up on iHeart and Stitcher and Spotify. And I collect these sites like people used to collect stamps and coins. They keep popping up and I keep signing up.
Well, that's hope for democracy that you're able to have so many outlets. And it's really good that we're getting rid of a Twitter.
Yeah.
It's excellent.
I think so. Well, either that or they're going to have to reform and stop the political censorship. Getter, G-E-T-T-R, is a good site that I'm on. I urge people to sign up for my Getter account because Getter is going gangbusters right now. Millions of people are jumping onto Getter. They don't censor political opinion. They do censor stuff that should be censored. Like, for example, Twitter and Facebook are drenched with porn. They also do censor violence and real potential terrorism, like the guy who held a synagogue hostage in Texas recently. He had Facebook, and he was advocating the most vile and hateful anti-Semitism. That would not have happened at Getter. So, they're just censoring conservative opinion. And I think they started doing it with the election of Donald Trump because that was a shock to the liberal establishment and they didn't know what to do about it. So they began to algorithm conservative opinion, but it really culminated with their banning of President Trump, the sitting president, is something I think they wanted to do for a long time, and his millions of followers on Twitter, simply because he tweeted out that he would not be attending the inauguration of Joseph Biden. Now that apparently was enough to make them ban him. So, I don't operate in that world at this point. Maybe I'm not quite getting the traction that I would if I did, even though they were shadow banning me like crazy. But I feel like I'm building something that's going to be based on the vision that I had for this thing, which is to have a vigorous, no holds barred political conversation with people from all sides without worrying about some nerd somewhere pulling it down.
Well, that's exactly right. You're doing the right thing. Because, our founders created this, the First Amendment. But when they did that, they never envisioned that private citizens like Google and Facebook and Twitter would censor their own citizens.
Right.
And that's exactly what's happening. And perhaps that Rule 230 should be revised. But the idea that these guys are private now, the fact is they're acting more like governments every day. Matter of fact, you can have a thriving business without the government, but you can't do that without Google and Facebook and emails.
That's so
they
right.
They really are, in fact, acting more and more like a government, and they shouldn't be censoring people.
No, they are. And I think that there's a certain level of collusion between them, not literally maybe, in that they're not sitting around some smoke-filled room somewhere, but
hot smoked.
They all seem to follow suit when it comes to the algorithm. And even a big news site like Breitbart, which has major, investigative reporters in Britain and in Israel and in other countries, they've lost algorithm through being put into a shadow ban. They've lost, a large share of listenership because of the manipulation of the code in those sites. And I don't know what can be done about it. My daughter tells me tough luck. That's competition. We live in a, do I want a free market or not? And I'm now seeing that in a way she's right, only in that I'm encouraged by the fact that Getter is doing so well, and that I think Rumble and some of the others, Odyssey, they're coming up, you know, and they're starting to take on YouTube. And yeah, maybe we will have competition, and maybe we will, they will become more relegated in coming months and years.
You should know that I live in the belly of the beast. I live in Los Gatos, California. Apple is 5 miles from me. Google is 10 miles from me. Facebook is 15 miles or less from me. So I'm surrounded by people who work in these areas, work in these companies. And I can tell you that they are all of the same mind. They don't need to sit around in a pot-filled smoke room to collaborate. They all think this.
Yeah.
They all switch, you know. Netflix is literally 100 yards from here. Okay. So I know these people inside out. I drink with them. I eat with them. I run into restaurants or run the golf courses, and they all think alike. Mm-hmm. They share the same values, and they don't need to collaborate. They all share the same political spectrum. So the idea that they're collaborating, it's not necessary. They just do that as a matter of course. They just believe the same things.
Right. They have a culture that's corrupt. I mean, it reminds me of my old communist uncle, Charlie. My father once asked him, he was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party back in the 1930s and 40s. And he asked him, my father as a young man, who looked up to him and who named me after him, actually. He said, how do you guys operate? Do you get your orders from the Kremlin? I mean, how does this work? And his answer was, no, we don't have to get orders from the Kremlin. We all know what to do. We all think alike. You know, we're all basically on the same page.
Liberals have a genetic deficiency that emanates because it changes, makes their whole brain system work differently than normal people. So they you know, it's like fish. Doesn't teach other fish to swim in a school. They already know it. It's genetically programmed. Mm. And it's the same way with liberals and Democrats in the media. They are, in fact, all think the same way because they've been indoctrinated the same way with CRT and wokeism. Yeah.
So, Harold, tell us a little bit about your work and what you're up to over there.
Well, my avocation is political writing. Mm-hmm. I have my own website because I was, you know,
yes,
difficult to publish what I publish, conservative thought, on Facebook. So I decided to create my own website and to write my bring my thoughts to life and to let people share them and read them. And that's what I do for a hobby / avocation. But right. I'm a technical writer by trade. I write for a company that we do work for NASA and GPL and the government. And so I do proposals and requests for information and communications for them. So those are the two things I do out here.
So
sooner or later, I'm going to stop and go be my, do what you do, go full-time political. And this would be a good time because 22.
Well, I do other things too. I mean, my wife tells me this is a hobby. So, but you know, in a way, like you and I both are examples of how a citizen can contribute and get involved in politics. Now there are all these tools, many of which are free, that you can take advantage of, and you can be heard. You know, you can do, and you can. You have an issue you care about, you want to get across the plate, you can do it in this day and age. I mean, and you can build on that and become active. I mean, one of the movements that I see right now that really encourages me is that, and this is something that President Trump should have mentioned. I don't think we could talk in hindsight, but you have thousands of people all across the United States right now getting involved in electoral politics. They're running for local town clerks. They're volunteering to work at voting booths and at counting rooms. There's supposed to be a Republican and a Democrat in the counting room when they count absentee ballots. That didn't happen last time.
That's correct.
You know, the Republican Party dropped the ball on that one. And meanwhile, the Democrats flooded those rooms with thousands of activists, people that were committed to stopping Trump. Zuckerberg wrote a check for $420 million, and they'll admit this. There was an article in Time magazine that talked about this, to fund these two kind of phony, baloney, liberal, radical groups who basically trained people to do just this, especially in the so-called swing states of Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. They were setting up tables and parks. They were harvesting votes out of nursing homes, you know, where they would fill empty ballots out for people who were suffering from dementia and even had passed away. They were just, you know,
Democrats, in other words.
yeah. But Democrats on speed. And we're talking about very determined people who felt it was a moral duty to stop Trump at any cost. I mean, does anybody really think that they were sitting in the counting room, and if they, you know, they see a Trump vote, it's like, that one goes over in this pile, you know, in the circular pile.
So it's good that Republicans have become aware of this and are now going to be more forceful in their monitoring of the polling booths. It's good news.
Oh yeah, I mean, and they're doing it all. I mean, we have, you know, housewives, retired people, teenagers, you know, empty nesters, you know, people, anybody who has a little time on your hands and you want to get involved in politics and really make a difference in this country, go to your local precinct, sign up for the local Republican town and city committee, you know, run for those local committees, get on the boards of these board of electors, you know, and become an elector. You know, this is really where the power is. And the Democrats knew this. I mean, Zuckerberg knew that when he wrote that check. You know, that was their way of taking the election. And it's being countered now. The mistake was made, and you can't go back to undo it. Well, maybe you can, but that's another story. The point is that, you know, going forward, we see the example, for example, in Virginia, where Glenn Youngkin, the only reason he was able to win in a state that he was not supposed to win was because he fielded thousands of people to do just what we're talking about. Plus, the Republican National Committee put some muscle behind it. They put some money behind it. They had lawyers on call ready to, at a drop of a dime, in case there was any shenanigans, to take action, who understand constitutional election law. So, you know, this is a movement that I'm encouraged by. What do you think, Harold?
Absolutely. It's a movement that was presaged by Mr. Youngkin's victory. His emphasis on killing CRT and wokeism is really a key for Republicans moving forward. And what you said just a minute ago about everyone getting involved, all conservatives and Republicans getting involved at the precinct level, at the local level, was something the Conservative Party conceived of under Project Mayberry. Mm-hmm. And if you guys can remember what Project Mayberry is, a TV show.
Right, the mythical town in North Carolina.
Small town, you know, and of course, Project Mayberry was our way of saying, pushing the activism down to the grassroots level, to the mayors, dog catchers, water boards, and especially education boards. And we tried to push that concept. We still do back in, you know, 10 years ago. So that's important.
Exactly. And you guys with your Conservative Party, like a lot of oftentimes is the case with third parties, their ideas eventually percolate up and are embraced by either they're embraced by one of the two parties or they become one of the two parties. That seems to be the pattern in American history. And you were one of the founders of the American Conservative Party in the 1990s. Is that right?
Well, it's not called the American Conservative Party. It's called Conservative Party USA.
Okay.
I'm not on the board anymore, but mm-hmm. I advise them and I do write for them once in a while. But I resigned about 5 or 6 years ago. I was chairman for 5 years, and I gave up. You know, 5 years is a long time to be chairman of a fledgling party. So I gave that up and gave other people a chance to run it. But they are still, in fact, gaining ground a little bit because the Tea Party, our biggest, quote, rival at the time, has dissolved into nothing.
Right.
And the reason why the Tea Party dissolved into nothing is because they were originally formed in a very fractious concept. They formed strictly to address fiscal responsibility,
mm-hmm.
you know, to for budget and deficits, et cetera. Right. And that people who, of all parts of the political spectrum, join the Tea Party and address that only. But a party cannot just be concerned about fiscal responsibility. It has to do moral, fiscal, educational, monetary fund, foreign policy.
Right.
And when a party tries to, when the Tea Party tried to do that, it split along all those people who were joined solely about fiscal issues were no longer part, and they would no longer agree about fiscal policy. They would no longer agree about social policy. They would no longer agree about, you know, domestic policy or social issues, so that they couldn't grow past their niche value. And as a result, now you don't even hear anything about them anymore.
Right. I mean, I think that they were drawn very much on the lines of the philosophy of Ayn Rand, and who was in a way one of the influences to the Libertarian Party, in that they really didn't, as you say, they didn't broaden their view to deal with other aspects of life. It was all just pocketbook, budget issues, taxes, which is fine, but that's only one small piece of the bigger picture, which is the bigger, you know, the sociological imagination, if you will.
Yes.
As C. Well,
one of the things that I always laughed at is when somebody said, I'm a social liberal and a fiscal conservative. It's such an ironic thing, because you cannot be socially liberal, because that costs money. You know, welfare and food stamps and all the 31 government handout programs all cost money. So you cannot be socially liberal.
Mm. And there's another name for that. It's RINO.
RINO, yes.
In a sense, I think that the Trump movement, the MAGA movement, is synthesized both economic and other aspects. And the one thing that I think Trump really was able to knock over the plate is this idea of putting America first.
Yes.
That's something that past politicians have given lip service to, because it sounds good on a bumper sticker. But Trump really meant it. You know, and it's obviously sensible if you take a look at the way life works. We put ourselves and our family first before we put other interests. That's just normal. It's normal to the human being. It's normal in the animal kingdom. It's normal in the plant kingdom. I mean, any living being puts, right? I mean, they put yourself first. But that was anathema to the socialistic, globalistic, internationalist left that has controlled this country since Woodrow Wilson. They have this demented idea that somehow the national state, borders, a national culture, these things are anachronisms, they're old-fashioned, they're wrong, you know, they have all this, you know.
You know, Donald Trump is a product of Republican Party failures.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to transcend beat all those 16 or 15 other candidates, because we, the rank and file people, the conservatives and true Republicans, were sick and tired of the Republican Party reneging on its campaign promises over and over and over again, especially the ones to repeal Obamacare and to pass balanced budgets and a whole slew of things. And as a result of that, all the establishment candidates fell by the wayside very quickly. Now, the Conservative Party, we actually endorsed in 2016 for that cycle. We endorsed Ted Cruz. Because Ted Cruz is a known conservative from day one,
there's
no doubt about that. And obviously, he knew very well what he was doing and knew what he was talking about. He could talk circles around, as far as policy goes, around Donald Trump.
Sure.
But the fact is, he was an establishment Republican, and we people in our party were evenly divided. And so when Trump finally won the primaries, won enough delegates, we all switched over and voted for Trump. But you know, Ted Cruz was really a fine guy, and we vote in our in the nomination paper that I wrote, we endorsed Ted Cruz officially, but gave Trump honorable mention right below him.
Yeah. I mean, Trump was not, you know, he really broke the mold. I don't think politics will ever be the same since Trump. I mean, he just, you know, people criticized him for his style and his way of speaking, which could be quite crude at times. But, you know, there was an honesty to him. I mean, it wasn't, we were getting, one of the reasons I think that he was well-liked was because he didn't use this kind of like, you know, what this beltway language, you know, this euphemisms and half-truths and double-speak and code words. And, you know, it's what French philosopher and scholar Elaine Benescon called the language of totalitarianism. You know, and one of the classic expositors of that was Obama. He could speak flowery and, you know, very sophisticated while he would look down his nose. And he would, it would all kind of go down like a gigantic, by a gigantic stick of cotton candy, you know.
No one would ever confuse Trump with Obama. That's correct.
That's right. Whereas Trump sometimes would go down a little more bitter, but you remembered what he had to say. You know, he was really speaking.
And you know, I was always struck by how strong this support is. Many of my friends are obviously really strong Trump supporters, but Trump broke my heart because he never was able to transition from a candidate to president. Mm-hmm. And the two are required different skills. He has the skills. He has the knowledge. But he chose not to transition, which is his strength and his weakness simultaneously.
Right.
And as a result, he broke my heart because I wanted him to succeed so much, and then he refused to make that little small change in his, and as a result, he ran into a lot of trouble. Most of it was manufactured, but some of it was self-induced.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, obviously, you know, he had his foibles, but, you know, I think that on the whole, it was an extraordinarily successful presidency, probably absolutely the most successful since FDR. I mean,
absolutely,
in terms of like getting, you know, if you take a look at any area, the economy, trade policy, dealing with China, foreign policy, you know, he avoided this situation that's been in place since the globalists took over, which is perpetual war for perpetual peace, as a historian Austin Beard called it, Charles Austin Beard. That's been the American policy. Trump never did any of that. He did not have any wars. He withdrew from wars. He went in, he finished off ISIS and then started withdrawals. And, you know, to my way of thinking, I mean, the world was much more stable. I mean, the result was, right?
Yeah. You know, look what we have now versus what happened.
It's horrible. I mean, now there's instability and catastrophe, and everybody is sitting on the edge of
Which is why he broke my heart, because I wanted him to win, but we needed him. You know, I write editorials, etc. I got exhausted after 3 years.
Yeah.
Defending him, because at some points, at some things, I couldn't defend. But the point is, what I admired so much about Trump was that he was the first president that I know of that really stood up to China and its trade policies and how they stole our intellectual property and how they were spying on us and stealing our, and just doing all the things, dumping currency, double dealing and everything. And he was the only president that really stood up to them finally. And what happened? Republicans were shy about supporting him, and the media attacked him because he's Trump. And he held his ground, and I really admired him for that. And so that's one of the main things why I continue to support him.
Now, Harold, I don't know if you wrote much about what President Trump, I think, quite accurately called the deep state.
Yes.
You know, what Tufts University Fletcher School of Government professor Michael Glennon called the double government. You know, and he was
shadow government.
And he wrote a book called Double Government. This is a guy who's establishment. I had him on my show. Brilliant man. You know, he was a Senate counsel to Obama. You know, he was like a real kind of new from the inside. And he talked about basically what President Trump talks about, even though he wasn't happy with me for bringing that up. But putting that aside, you know, they went after Trump with both fists. I mean, they really, you know, Eisenhower called it the military-industrial complex as he was walking out the door, you know, in the last moments of being in office, after having, I think, played ball with them for 8 years. Trump really didn't play ball with them, and they took him on with both fists. I mean,
couldn't control him because he didn't need their money.
That's right. He was completely independent. He didn't, you know, he didn't even need, you know, he's one of these figures that he didn't need the job. I mean, he.
Right. And the thing is, see, Trump knew what you and I know. He knew intrinsically what was wrong. He was right in his attitudes. He was not effective in dealing with it. I did write about this. Just before he got inaugurated, after he won the election, he made a major mistake by sticking an eye into the CIA, by accusing the CIA of spying on him, everything, and undermining. And
of course, they were spying on
him. That's right. It was true. Okay. And I said he was affected. And I'm going, well, look, the last thing you want to do is start your presidency by pissing off all the guys at the CIA.
Right.
The last thing you want to do is do that, because they're past masters at undermining presidents, dictators, everywhere, all over the world. And so all he had to do was just take him aside and privately and tell him what was going on. But being Trump,
he blew it out publicly.
He was going to do this publicly. And as a result, he made what needlessly a whole bunch of enemies in the CIA before he even got inaugurated. And I just thought that was was correct. He could have done it a little differently, just like he could have done it. Could have done it a little differently when he rightfully criticized Sessions for recusing himself. I mean, Sessions was a wimpy, sissy, typical Republican,
right,
who abandoned his president, who vacated all the good that he built up, credibility built up by first being the first senator to endorse Trump. And then he turns around and gets in and gives up, you know, and allows the rogue state, the deep state, the shadow government to run wild and have all these investigations. And so Trump was correct in chastising him, but then what he should have done was get Sessions on the phone and bring him over to the White House and read him the Riot Act. But you can't
instead undermine of humiliating him publicly. Yeah, I agree. I mean, Trump sometimes, you know, he did not make friends. I mean, he should never have insulted John McCain, for example. That right. Really, you know, he'd make these. And that was really a stupid.
No, he was right. He was right to do it, you know.
But it came back to hurt him because McCain is such a vindictive, right, nasty man, and he was so bitter over having lost.
Right.
Same thing with Mitt Romney, but McCain ended up voting against removing Obamacare over this. Exactly. So the whole country suffered because, you know, just because McCain wanted to get back at Trump, right, didn't want Trump to have a victory. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, there's a bit of a lacking of certain diplomatic skills there. I mean,
well, I just thought he had, you know, and the thing is, he had the good advisors. I love his advisors. You know, I even like Michael Flynn. All these guys, and then Cheney, and I mean, this is not Cheney, Pence. And he had good advice.
But Pence ended up stabbing him in the back, in my opinion.
At the end, yes. But, yeah, but
even in the beginning,
not at first.
When he stabbed him in the back through throwing General Flynn under the bus, you know, it's sort of, he turned out not to be who we might have thought he was.
So the question remains now, can Trump be valuable? The most important thing is that the conservatives and Republicans have to take back the House and the Senate. I think that we're going to be able to do that in 2022. Mm-hmm. The question is, at how much will Trump get involved in that? And will he be able to, you know, some like Junket did, he helped put him at arm's length. Well, that's going to work sometimes. In other places, Trump's going to be very valuable. And the question is, will Trump be able to discern which times it would be good for him to get directly involved in a camp in a campaign, a House campaign or Senate campaign, and which ones to stay out. And so that's going to be a test.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think he handled the Youngkin campaign well. He is still the titular head of the Republican Party. And, the liberals are screaming about this. Oh, people are loyal to Trump as if it's like some kind of a cult thing. But they are. I mean, he's a force of nature.
Yes, he is.
And I do think that he may run again. And I think that if he does, I think he will win another term. It'll be like Grover Cleveland. It'll be his third term.
his third term. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. But the idea, though, is that I hear people abusing, you just remind me of this, that their election was rigged. Okay? We can argue and agree or disagree or whatever. But the point I'm going to be making this more often, is that we as conservatives and Republicans must stop telling people the election was rigged and the election will be rigged and it's going to be rigged, because it destroys the very impetus for us to go out and vote. We got to put the past behind us. We can't say, hey, the election's going to be rigged, vote for me. Well, why?
I know what you mean. If people feel the election's rigged, they're going to feel like, well, why bother voting then?
Why bother voting? So Republicans got to stop doing this. What we have to say is we are going to make sure that it's properly policed and monitored, but it's not rigged. If to say otherwise would discourage the very people that we want to go out and vote to vote. So we got to stop doing it on our side. And of course, the greatest undermining factor in any democracy is that the liberals are now saying the election is rigged.
Now all of a sudden they're like putting
on. Now we have everybody saying the election's rigged. Now that's the threat to democracy. Okay.
Right. The problem is that the election was rigged and that we need to get to a grip on that or we're going to have another free election.
Was the key.
Well, the point is, until we get a grip on how that happened and fix it, we're not going to have another free election. They're going to do it again.
We got to monitor, like I think one of your previous guests, Josh Bernstein, said, we got to put people in those precincts. We got to have monitors. We got to have people who are conservatives, watching all the polling places. That's what we got to do.
Look, Harold, you make a good point in that I think that the way they played the Youngkin thing was that the Republican National Committee got very involved and they put a lot of money into it because they know damn well that election was stolen, but they didn't say it publicly. They just proceeded with that understanding. In other words, it wasn't stolen, and it's like a corporate head being accused of a crime. You know, they get out of court and they go, we didn't do it and we shall continue not doing it going forward. So it's like that, you know, it wasn't rigged and it's not going to get rigged again.
Right. Exactly right. So the key is we have to learn from our mistakes and monitor those things and make sure that we have drive our people out to vote, make sure they believe that their vote counts, and make sure we monitor the system and the machines and the polling places to ensure that this doesn't happen again.
Indeed. So, Harold, what do you think is coming down the pike then in this? Because the midterms are less than a year away. I think that they're actually only 8 months away.
Yes.
And I'm listening to liberal podcasts. One of the liberal podcasts I listen to that's very good is none other than James Carville. Very entertaining, right?
Yes.
And their head is spinning over this.
Yes. That's good. And we're all on the right track. And I'm in the middle of writing five platforms that the Republicans have to do to maintain and keep talking points that they have to maintain and hit repeatedly and hard between now and the election. Obviously, the first thing we have to do is not get complacent, okay?
Right.
And the second thing is we have to get Republicans to finally fully embrace the culture war that we have been so afraid to embrace, as evidenced in your book, Socialism for Conservatives.
Right.
You obviously and you properly point out that Republicans have been loath to embrace the culture wars. Meanwhile, Democrats, liberals, and media That's all they do is the culture wars. And right. So as a result, they've outmaneuvered us. And now we have to stop that now. And so I think that the key is we have to, number one, we have to attack continuously Biden's and Democrats on the illegal immigration. The second thing we have to attack the Democrats on is the crime, Demo Crime Party. Mm-hmm. That's running rampant. And the two things I just mentioned are going to repeat the theme that's going to recur is that they actually cannot fight back on these issues. They own it.
Right.
And they have to. There's no way that they can disown it, because if they do, they'd lose half the people that vote for them. The third thing that we have to fight and make sure that we get people to do is continue what Youngkin has done, is that kill CRT and wokeism at every turn.
Yes.
With every Democrat on record. Do they support CRT or don't they? Do they support workism or don't they? And when we put their feet to the fire and make them go on record as to what they do, then they are really going to be stuck. Because if they say, yes, I support CRT, bang, you got them. And if they say, no, I don't support CRT, bang, you got them, because their constituents won't vote for them. Then we obviously have to move them back. I mean, those are the same thing. Hey, look at what they can't fight back on illegal immigration. They cannot. There's nothing they can say about it.
No, it's a disaster.
And the same thing with CRT, same thing with the national debt and crime. Look at all the crime. And they are the Democrats, not Biden, but the rest of the Democrat Party was for defunding the police. And mm-hmm. every Democrat running big cities, including the district attorneys, are woke, sick dog, twisted, mentally deficient people who are encouraging crime.
Yeah, you have all these. This is another reason why Trump lost and why this sort of Democrat cabal has taken over, because a certain multi-billionaire Hungarian activist, who we know who I'm talking about, knew where the power. Yes, that's right. And he knew where the power resided, and help get elected all of these district attorneys who are now letting people out on $1,000 bail, as if there's some virtue to that, like the guy that ran his car into a bunch of old ladies at the at a Christmas parade in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Now this guy was let out on $1,000
bail. I didn't do it. The car did it.
The car did it. And this other one, he murdered a girl right in front of UCLA. He was out on $1,000 bail. These are violent criminals.
Yes.
And they think there's some kind of a virtue. Now you have these DAs in the major cities and in New York City even, and in contradiction to the new mayor, announcing that they're just not going to prosecute anyone short of murder.
Yes.
That's like a dentist announcing they're not going to drill cavities anymore. This is their job.
I wrote an article, a short article about that. That's what they care more about criminals than they do about the citizens and the victims, which means we are properly entitled to call them the Democrine Party. And my brother-in-law, who was an ex-cop, took my article and passed it around in Philadelphia, took my article and passed it around everybody around, all his policeman friends. They are the Democrine Party. And Republicans should fully embrace that term and hang that around the Democrats' neck like boat anchors, so that we can take advantage of them. I always fear that Republicans don't have the cojones, the mental fortitude to really use the tools at their disposal to defeat Democrats. And they always pull back.
Why is that?
They're punching.
Why?
Well, because they're Republicans, which is why I left them. Republicans care about, first of all, they're infiltrated by rhinos up and down. They're afraid of conflict. They're worried about what the newspapers say about them instead of what their constituents say about them. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the courage of their convictions, which has been the real reason why the Republicans, which is why Trump won the nomination, because we all know the Republicans don't have what it takes to be viscerally, really be committed to the fight. They buy into this idea that we should not embrace the culture wars. And meanwhile, we're getting handed to it. The biggest flaw the Republicans have is that we've allowed the liberals, the CRT people, to move us in the education world for the past 20 years. And as a result, we have this monstrosity of an ideology that's acting like a cancer throughout our nation's education system. We have these kids who are just totally nonsensically, no common sense, like Bill Maher and, you know, what's his name? The guy you just mentioned, Carville, said, the party of no common sense. Not only are they the party of the Democratic Crime Party, they're the no common sense party. And Republicans need to fully embrace that, lovingly embrace it, and enlist in the war that they have always been, for some reason, loath to accept the necessity of doing that.
Well, I mean, I think that Republicans are like to have their big fat face up on the big screen as much as anyone else, especially with Facebook and these big media who are going to shut them down unless they play ball.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's if they can make you invisible, and politicians like to be as visible as they can. And I think it's a very corrupting influence. But the only other thing I would add to your excellent list of issues is the pandemic, which the blue states. I mean, they're putting children in with these these face masks, and they want to give them vaccines. It's insane.
Sure, but it's evil. You know, Charles, that the reason why it's fifth on my list is because it's not a slam dunk like the other four are against Democrats.
Okay,
there are plausible explanations. And there's enough information and talking points out there that some Democrats can plausibly put up and speak eloquently to the value of vaccines and the value of masks. There is enough.
But the mandates, I mean, like.
Mandates, no.
Well, that's an issue. I mean, I don't know. The whole thing might go away anyway because of the.
What I'm saying is the other four points, they can't. Their hands are tough. Their ideology handcuffs.
But I do think that fifth point, like right now around the world, if you go to like in Brussels and in Brasilia, in Brazil, millions of people are on the street protesting. I mean, and I think that it's happening in the United States, not quite at that scale, but you have these big blue state city mayors, like my own mayor here in Boston, Michelle Wu, passing a law saying that you have to show a passport to go into a restaurant, a store, a bank, a gym. You know, I don't think, well, first of all, I just don't think it's going to work. I don't think anyone's going to do it here in Boston.
Not viable.
Yeah, no one's going to, the police aren't going to enforce it. No restaurant is going to do that because they'll be out of business. No one wants that. And so, you know, it's like what Attorney General Harry Daugherty under Calvin Coolidge once said, the best way to get rid of a bad law is to enforce it. And I think that's what's going to happen, because otherwise Boston is going to look like East Berlin.
Mandates are not viable, and they are not effective, and they're obviously unconstitutional, just like the Supreme Court just ruled for business. Now, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but there seems to be, if they say it's unconstitutional for companies to do it, then maybe there's some reason they might rule that it's unconstitutional for states.
Well, it's unconstitutional for cities and states to do it. I mean, a company can do it if they want to. I mean, but
probably true, but I'm not sure.
So I think that it's a losing issue for them. I think it's hurting people, hurting children. And some of these people just, it's like they're in some kind of a cult. I mean, they I see them in Boston, you know, they got double masks strapped onto their face while they're walking alone on the street.
I see guys drive around in their cars with masks.
In the car. It's bizarre.
Yes, it is bizarre. Now here's the thing. They have in California, you know, they have these silly rules. You got to have your mask on to go into a restaurant. But as soon as you go into the restaurant and sit down,
you can take it off.
You know, we just watched the 49ers, you know, big football at a local bar here. And the place was packed. And everybody walked in with a mask, and they get in the door, they put their masks in, and everybody's yelling and screaming, hugging each other, they had no masks. Yet everybody on the staff, of course, had to have a mask. And so it shows you how ridiculous it is. And just like if you watch those games, nobody had masks on in the stands. So your point is valid, is that these mandates are ineffective, probably unconstitutional, but mostly it becomes a wedge issue that they will lose.
It is. And I think that issue alone is enough it should be enough to get the Republicans elected in both houses, because then we'll finally have an investigation and we'll find out who is behind, like maybe the gain of function element. Where did this thing come from? Who knew about that? Who made money from that? What about the fact that, you know, early treatment was banned and made difficult, things like ivermectin? I can say that word now here on Rumble. I couldn't say if I said ivermectin on YouTube, I would have been banned. And it's something it's FDA approved. It works. It's been around for decades. The guy that invented it got a Nobel Prize for that. I mean, this is a proven drug that works well against vaccines. And now the internal memos are now coming out, leaking out, showing that there was a deliberate attempt to suppress ivermectin and other remedies like hydroxychloroquine, which means that whoever did that is responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people who could have gotten treated. I think that if we elect Republicans, that's going to be investigated like crazy. We're going to get to the bottom of this. It's a huge scandal. So to my way of thinking, Republicans should run on that and say, you know, if we don't...
It's not top of mind. The reason why, they could speak to it just like you have, very eloquently. But once again, I emphasize, the points that I've made, the four elements of the platform, they cannot be defended by the Democrats cannot defend themselves on. And they're huge, important issues. And if we put them on record on every one of these things, they cannot defend themselves. Whereas there is some wiggle room on the COVID thing. Not much.
Okay.
We shouldn't, you know, I hear some of my conservative friends say we should impeach Biden because of the crimes he committed as far as keeping the border open. Once again, that is exactly true. He has committed crimes by opening the border. But if we say that as one of our campaign things, will embolden and enrage and invigorate Democrats.
I agree. I think that's a loser. I don't think we need to talk about impeachment.
They don't want it right now. Keep them demoralized, kick them when they're down, hit them in the head with the issues that they can't fight back on. But as soon as you say we're going to impeach.
No, I agree. I agree. That's a loser. No, that's not the way to go. The way to go is to win in both houses with historic margins, so that we can at least overcome the rhinos and keep things in place. Right. And then re-elect Trump or re-elect another Republican, hopefully Trump. But as you know, in 2 years from then, the whole impeachment thing, that's not going to make it. They spent 4 years trying to impeach Trump.
Don't say nonsense like that before the 2020 election, this midterm. Can't say that. As far as Trump goes, running, you know, one of my funniest favorite quotable senators in South Carolina.
Lindsey Graham.
Yeah. Lindsey Graham said last week that I think was pretty, pretty, pretty appropriate. He says Donald Trump could win the nomination and the general election if he runs a disciplined campaign. And I smiled, and then I started laughing because.
Although I have to say, he does seem to be a little bit more disciplined now. I mean,
he could, but the operative word is
discipline. Yeah. I mean, I know he does tend to shoot off the
And I would love to see that. You know, I love the reaction when Donald Trump won the election and election night. And I just made my heart warm sing with joy. And I'd like to see that again. And he would be that way. He would win again if he runs a disciplined campaign.
If he does. And I think that he seems to be more disciplined than he was. He seems to.
That's easy to do.
and I think he's not, he does, you know, he had a lot of people around him who were not, you know, who kind of, I think, had the knife out for him. They were constantly.
Yeah, Charles, that's the thing that made me, one of the other things besides him, that made me sad was because he turned out to be the political alchemist. He turned gold into lead. And by that, I mean, he had so many wonderful friends, allies, and staffers and people who worked for them, who he turned into enemies. And I was so struck and saddened by that, some of the generals and Kelly and
right.
chief of staff and Bolton and the list goes on and on and on. Scaramucci and all these guys that who really loved and supported him, then he turned into enemies and now are actually working.
Oh, they're rapidly at Trump.
Yeah, and I was, and I'm so sad to see that because Trump is such a talented guy who had such the right visions and the right things to go on that he would that it would turn out like that, and that's shocking, sadly.
It is. Look, he's not, as we say, he's not a perfect person, but and everybody has their strengths and weaknesses, but.
Let's work towards together.
Yeah,
we keep Republicans squared away and keep Trump on rail. Now, the fact is, I really blame a lot of Trump's problems on Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Levine, mm-hmm. because Trump really listened to them.
Yeah,
he listened to them time and time again, and they never once that I know in public.
Yeah.
Told Trump, look, you're blowing it. You got to do this. You got to do that. You got to do that. Now, they said that in private. I mean, I heard it that Hannity told him during the January 6th insurrection to get involved. But they never publicly asked Trump to get in line and to save himself. And if they would have, again, I don't know what they said privately. Maybe they did. But if they would have just once said, Mr. Trump, Mr. President, let's stay this way. We could win if you just do these things. And they never did, as far as I know.
No, I hear you. I mean, it's a tragedy for the country because he stood for the right things and still does. And, one of the great, the inaugural address, he really laid out that he's neither Democrat or Republican. He wants to return power to the citizen. And I think he meant that, and that was the first thing that would have happened.
He's the first Republican who means what he says. He means what he says. That's, say what you will about Mr. Trump. He means what he says and says what he means. And that's why I really enjoyed supporting him. And I would really dearly enjoy him running and winning again.
Oh my God, that would be a beautiful thing.
That'd be something. the Democrats and rhinos and media all collaborated with China to undermine him, during the pandemic.
Oh, clearly.
Clearly they did, Well, he's the only president who stood up to China's abuses. And what did the media do? They, instead of criticizing the Chinese for stealing us blind, they criticized Trump.
China has so much money poured into political coffers, including Republicans like Mitch McConnell, but also, certainly the Biden family. We know that they got who knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, how serious is that? You have Chinese communist spies and infiltrating all over the place.
Yeah. It is serious. Newt Gingrich wrote a wonderful book about how Trump is standing up to the Chinese.
Yeah.
And it has example after example. And the Chinese are they're brilliant. They have 50-year plans and, we're lucky if we come up with a one-year plan. But their 50-year plan is just like the CRT is undermining our schools and children. They post Chinese spies in colleges and universities because they know if somebody, especially like Trump says, you have a Chinese spy, the knee-jerk reaction of colleges and universities, oh, you're racist, and the Chinese know that. The Chinese can undermine and suborn people like Eric Swalwell with the honeypot, woman spy, because they know that if the Trump administration and a Republican would chastise Swalwell for that, they would cry racism.
Sure.
Racism.
They know that that's the weakness. It's political correctness.
They would never do that to Republicans because
they play that card because just like they'll play a card to, that's how communism works. I mean, that's how if you look at Marx's Communist Manifesto, he talks about this. You know, right. You have to kind of use the tactics of subterfuge in a society by studying that particular society that you're targeting, identify the weakness, and then infiltrate there and wedge in that way. I mean, there's different methodologies that they've used against different countries.
Right. And in this once you country, take money from them, you know, those Harvard professors, your boys down at Harvard, they just put a guy in jail, not because he took money from the Chinese, but because he took money and didn't report it. Okay.
Well, they get, it's like they got him on a tax. It's like getting Al Capone for tax evasion.
Right. So, but there's a things like that, and that's, they know how to play the game. And our Google is helping the Chinese develop AI supercomputers for money. NBA plays in China for money. They complain about the civil rights here and the Georgia voting laws, yet they go play basketball in China, who have true human rights violations with the slave.
It's a terrible, and now with the Olympics, it's like the Nazi Olympics of 1936. Yeah. But you know, George Gilder is one of America's most respected intellectuals. He spent about 10 years in China, I think, working during the maybe the Clinton or the first Bush administration. And he says that, I heard him interviewed recently, that China, you know, that Google and the big tech companies are playing ball with China by censoring inside China and by supporting Chinese efforts to create a score, you know, like a social score.
Yes, social right.
So if you have a low social score in China, you get no rights. You can't even leave your village. Whereas if you got a higher score and you're in the Communist Party, you live high. I mean, it's lavish, incredible. I mean, you know, the way the top echelon live, it would make any capitalist captain of industry blush. Yeah. I mean, they were all like that. I mean, Castro was like that. Arafat. You know, these people live very, very well on basically because they were being rewarded for standing up for the little guy. But Gilda's point was that they're doing that here. They are implementing the same. They want to implement it here, not quite formally like they do there, but they're giving businesses scores on several things. They have, like, I think it's called the ESB score, you know, environmental, social justice, and I think racial justice. And if businesses don't have a high enough score in any one of those areas, they're going to get shadow banned. They're going to get boycotts. They're going to be driven out. I mean, it's very, very troubling. And it's very particularly bad given the sort of the rise of, artificial intelligence, transhumanism, you know, the ability to transfer enormous amounts of data and artificial, intelligence into use in this way.
Right.
What do you think?
And that's absolutely true. Our own people, Google, Facebook, Apple, Twitter, et cetera, the high tech companies around here, are suborning and undermining America for the sake of short-term profits. I used to be in the semiconductor industry. I railed against Intel for putting a major semiconductor plant in China. The microprocessor is one of the most wondrous things that there is. And we were teaching Chinese to do it, create it. Now they can surpass us. And we want to know why we do it. And now Apple and Google and Facebook and those other high-tech companies are doing the same thing. Amazon doing the same thing for short-term profits. It's a crying shame. I'm glad that you know it and other people are beginning to know it. And this valley is filled with hypocrites. Mm. You know, on one hand, human rights, human poverty, equal rights, equal access, transgender this and transgender that. And then you turn around and you support regimes that throw transgenders off roofs and enslave people who don't agree with them.
Well, it's part of what are they? There's a word for this. It's like multi-connectivism or something.
I can't say ivermectin yet, so you won't.
You can have like feminist groups, in bed with a radical Islamic group, which puts women in burqas.
Right.
And they it's kind of, I forget the word for it. Maybe I'm having a senior moment here, but.
Hypocrisy, I call it. It's simple.
Yeah.
Rampant greed and hypocrisy.
All right. So, Harold, let my listeners and viewers know where they can look at your website and, you know, how they can get information.
Sure. My nom de plume is New Centurion.
Yes.
And SPQA. SPQA is a term initials I lifted from the Romans.
You go. I thought that Rome. Sounded familiar. Yeah.
So SPQR. And mm-hmm. SPQR is for the Senate and people of Rome. I'm centurion in Roman toga. SPQA is for the Senate and people of America. So just go to www.newcenturion.us and you'll see all of my blogs, all my editorials, all my writings and essays. If you're a conservative, I'm confident you will enjoy reading it. And it's been a real pleasure speaking to you. And I hope to speak with you again soon.
Absolutely, Harold. Let's do it regularly. And, you know, I recommend your website, New Centurion, for great articles and inspiring information and being up to date on what's going on. So, Harold, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. My pleasure. Bye-bye, everyone.
All right. Bye-bye. And we've got, I think, Chuck Slavin might be with us shortly. Chuck said he may be able to make it. I don't know, but... In the meantime, let me mention, if I might, that the program is self-sponsored by yours truly in the form of my books. Check them out. They're available at Amazon Books. Charles Moskowitz, The Satanic Conspiracy, which you see right behind me, is a recent book of mine. Sociology for Conservatives is my most recent book. I'm working on a new book right now. I'm really starting to just, you know, when you write a book, it takes a while to sort of set the table, but now I'm in it, and it's going to be called The Biden Coup. So I'm looking forward to that. Check out my books, again, available at Amazon Books. I don't have advertising yet, namely because I don't have that kind of audience yet, but, and plus, you know, because of controversy, it might take a while. And I also do not ask for money. Don't send me money. I wouldn't know what to do with it if you did. So I've got some interesting shows coming up this week. I've got Ryan Dawson coming up Wednesday night from Japan. Ryan is very well-versed in international and military matters. He had a huge following on YouTube before he started to get banned over there. He supports the Palestinian cause. I don't agree with him, but he's very interesting and he's got a lot to say. I'm looking forward to that. I've also been invited to join Tom Jump, who is considered the most prominent atheist on YouTube. He wants proof of the existence of God, evidence of God, and I'm going to be on with him taking the position that there is a God. He is a very smart guy. I've been watching his videos. He's very tough. And I also think he's a nice guy and that he's not one of these types that you see often who is mean and who's bitter and who's angry. You know, he's a serious scholar and he's an atheist. I don't agree with him at all. But, you know, I'm looking forward to a good, solid, reasonable discussion with him. You know, again, the program is Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. to whenever. I mean, eventually I'd like to keep it up till midnight, but, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to sustain that unless I have guests and calls, which, of course, brings me to the, let me just see here. Let me go to the website and suggest that you call in and you can chat with me on Rumble. But the phone number is 617-396-4958. That's 617-396-4958. I'm doing a bit of an open line segment. I just want to see if Chuck Slavin as well is able to join me. If not, then I'm probably going to sign off soon. But in the meantime, while we wait, you can call in the program if you're listening live at 617-396-4958. So come on down Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern Standard Time, as I build this great experience and hopefully participatory experience where we can all get together and really dig into issues that affect our lives and maybe have a few laughs too, hopefully, and just do this thing of mine. I mean, do this thing of yours, hopefully. So anyways, I don't see Chuck, so I'm probably going to sign off soon, but let me just give him another minute to see if he's going to come on. I'm also getting Jovan Hutton Pulitzer, who was one of the masterminds of the forensic audit in Maricopa County. He's a statistical expert who talks about what happened in the 2020 election. I'm not giving up on that. You know, I'm going to stay with that subject as long as I can. I'm listening today to James Carville, and he had on this guy from the Phony Baloney Center for Constitutional Rights, or the Brennan Institute, which was funded by that Hungarian billionaire, and which came up with the idea that it's somehow racist to ask for voter ID. And he has a book out. I'm going to invite him on. I don't think he'll come on with me, but you know, if he's so convinced that that there was no theft in the election, then given the fact that around 60% of Republicans believe there was, why not get behind and why not support the forensic audits in all of the states that are still being questioned? Why the big fight against that? If the election was the most secure and honest election in history, why the big contest against that, huh? Anyway, listen, I want to thank you all for joining me this evening. Charles Moskowitz, I shall return, God willing, tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thank you very much. God bless you all. And thank you and have a good evening, everybody.